Turn together to Deuteronomy chapter 23. The first two verses speak of those who cannot enter the assembly of Israel, and they seem to be talking about the results of practices done in pagan worship, that there were things done in the worship of false gods that would render someone permanently barred from the assembly of Israel. The assembly meant Israel gathered for worship. It meant the covenant community. It wasn't everybody in Israel. Israel as a whole would include resident aliens. And the Hebrew word is the kahal. The kahal is the assembly, interestingly enough, in the Septuagint. When the Old Testament was translated into Greek, the word that they used was ekklesia. And so when Jesus says he will build his ekklesia, and we find the word ekklesia over and over again for church in the New Testament, there's a direct connection there between the ekklesia and the kahal of ancient Israel. But the point is that there were some self-inflicted wounds, and probably verse 3 is talking about someone born to a cult prostitute, possibly someone born from an illegal, sinful union by blood kin, but more likely that it was someone whose birth came about through activity done in worship to a false god. And so the idea here is that there are some sinful activities that simply bar someone for life. Even to the 10th generation, 10 being a number for completeness, that probably means permanent exclusion. In verse 3, it says, no Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of the Lord. Again, there's that phrase, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of the Lord forever. Forever seems to be a synonym for the 10th generation. So there's a symbolic number, more than likely. The reason for the Ammonites was that they did not meet the nation with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt. And the lack of hospitality and brotherhood shown to Israel is going to be punished forever. And then there's a second group, the Moabites. And you remember that it was the king of Moab who sent for the prophet Balaam. And he sent for him with the express purpose of having him curse the Israelites. What happened when Balaam tried to do that? He kept blessing them. The Lord kept putting words in his mouth that would bless them, and by implication, as Presbyterians would say, what's a good and necessary deduction? A good and necessary deduction is that if Israel was going to be blessed, it was going to be the Moabites who were going to be cursed. And therefore, you have here an attack against Israel that was thwarted by God and turned against the Moabites. It says, because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. But the Lord your God would not listen to Balaam. I love that anthropomorphism about the Lord there. Aren't you glad that the Lord doesn't listen to some people? I can remember many years ago when I left the Assemblies of God, the Kahal of God. And a friend of mine was telling me that he and a pastor were praying in that pastor's church early one morning. The pastor was praying that the Lord would restore me to the Assemblies of God and turn my feet back into the right way. And the guy at the other end of the altar was praying, Lord, keep him where he is. And so it is good that the Lord does not listen to certain prayers. And he did not listen to Balaam. But instead, the Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loved you. You shall not seek their peace or their prosperity all your days forever. And one of the interesting things that you're about to see in this chapter tonight is the combination of harshness and compassion, of toughness and tenderness, of judgment and grace. Because we have here in these first six verses some very serious prohibitions here against anyone either entering the assembly of the Lord or dwelling in this future nation of Israel when they go in to take the promised land. And yet at the same time, mixed in with all of these things are provisions of a loving God. And his love, of course, is mentioned right here in verse 5. The Lord your God turned the curse into a blessing for you because the Lord your God loved you. So here is a situation where you are blessed by the Lord, but in verse 6, you're not to seek peace with the Ammonites, you're not to seek peace with the Moabites or their prosperity all your days forever. Now that sounds very harsh and unforgiving, and it is. But at the same time, verses 7 and 8 are rather surprising in their compassion. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. Why? Why should an Edomite be brother to Israel?
They were also enslaved.
No. It's the descendants of Esau. And sometimes, of course, the nation is personified in the name of the person for whom it's named. For example, the psalmist says, the God of Jacob is our refuge, and the prophets will say, Hear, O Israel, take heed, O Jacob. Well, what they are saying there is the nation, of course, but they're using individual names. Well, Esau was Edom. And so, when it says, he is your brother, that goes back to the two literal brothers, Jacob and Esau. And of course, Esau was not elect, as we find out in Romans 9. But he was forgiving of Jacob. And they agreed to not dwell with each other. And so they are not quite kissing cousins, but they are at least cognizant of the fact that they're family members. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. Here is the surprising one. You shall not abhor an Egyptian. What? You shall not abhor an Egyptian because you were a sojourner in his land. Yes, how are you doing, Joe?
God in his mercy sent that Jacob and his family got to Egypt because Egyptians contested shepherds. Put them in a land where they were free, they had their own cattle and stuff, and they thrived. And actually, the word said they swore.
Yeah.
There were so many of them.
Right. Yeah. So for many years, until the Pharaoh arose who knew not Joseph, it was a win-win. And the interesting thing is, they were brought to Egypt, as this whole study is talking about, in the providence of God, in order to save the nation, in order to keep much people alive. And this is why Joseph could say to his trembling brothers, "So it was not you who sent me here, but God. You intended it for evil, but God intended it for good, to save many people alive." And so what this is hearkening back to is those early days in Egypt. This is not going back to the Pharaoh that Moses encountered and the plagues on Egypt and the triumph over the Egyptians in the Red Sea. This is going back to an earlier period. And God is saying, in His mercy, you were a sojourner in there, and in the land of Egypt. And so children born to Edomites and Egyptians who moved to Israel may enter the assembly of the Lord in the third generation. This is a pathway to citizenship. You understand that after three generations that they're probably going to be faithful, reliable Israelites. And you let them in to the assembly of the Lord. It's kind of interesting how having a relationship with someone from years ago does in fact make a difference sometimes. That happened to me this week. Those of you who have been reading the emails know about the stuff going on with just really basically one neighbor, and you all know who he is, the guy with the Swiss Army Jeep and the cones out in front of his house. And we're going to give his house a wide berth. But the person who complained, and whose email I sent to you earlier this week, meant something somewhat different than what he said. He actually meant that he had spoken at the neighborhood association on behalf of this grievous neighbor, and or on behalf of all of the neighbors, and he really thought that all the neighbors were for us. Then he found out that this guy was against us, and this guy made false charges, which our guy, I don't know if he believed or not, but he was just passing on what this neighbor was charging. And he said, "I withdraw my support." Well, I went to see him today, and we had a good little talk, and he said that he didn't mean that he didn't support us. He meant that he couldn't support us as a representative of all the neighbors, and he misrepresented things at the meeting. So he said, "I support you. You can park in my driveway anytime you want to." I said, "Will you write a letter to that effect to the discussion list, correcting that?" He said, "Oh yeah, sure." So everything's cool. But the point is this. One of the letters, and as I told you in the email, the neighbors are very much in support of us. They're rallying to our defense. It's been a pleasure to read all of their posts on this email site as they argued against this guy's email and defended us. Someone asked, you'll get a kick out of this, they ask, "Well, where are these issues about variances decided as pertaining to the neighborhood input?" And one guy wrote back, "They are decided at the monthly meetings at Day Spring Chapel, who for 12 years now have not charged us for meeting and have let us meet out of kindness there." So that's been great, but here's what's relevant to our text in going way back. One of the emails that was posted said, "I'm in Europe, but I own two houses on Avenue G, and I'm enthusiastically in favor of the variance. Can I vote absentee or in absentia?" And I looked at the line, and this was a woman that Barbara and I had worked with years ago, who's a Christian, who helped put on the first LaBrie conference many years ago here in the early 80s. And now she owns a couple of houses on Avenue G. She knows us. She knows the church and is for us and cast her vote of support from Europe. Isn't that amazing? Anyway, this is about going back in a relationship with Egypt before that wicked Pharaoh, when there was a relationship with Egyptians that was beneficial to Israel. And it's amazing about how your bread cast upon the waters returns, and and the Egyptians can eventually, as they live in Israel, should they choose to move there, have their children, at least, from the third generation, enter the assembly of the Lord. Another interesting thing is this whole concept in the next series of verses, 9 through 14, and this is talking about things that make a soldier unclean, and the necessity of digging latrines. There's a place outside the camp, and the latrine should be dug out there. In verse 14, this is the interesting idea. Because the Lord your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy, so that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. So this is a fascinating idea, isn't it? It is saying, obviously, there are hygienical issues here, issues of hygiene, issues of appropriateness, but another primary issue is the presence of the Lord. And this is something that we understand from worship. We understand the Spirit of the Lord is in this place. We understand that God is with us all the time. But there are places that he deliberately designates as places in which he dwells. There in this camp of Israel would be the Ark of the Covenant, the tabernacle in the wilderness, and because the Lord walks in the midst of the camp to deliver you and to give up your enemies before you, therefore your camp must be holy. So it's not even just the fact that they have the shrine to the Lord in the camp, and it's a holy place because of that. It is saying that this same Lord that walked in the Garden of Eden in the cool of the day is actually present in the camp. And he's there to deliver you, give up your enemies. Now you have to honor his presence by scrupulously using a latrine. And you might take note of the word indecent in verse 14. So that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. Just make a mental note of that, because we're going to encounter that word again next week, when we talk about the famous Deuteronomy divorce passage. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her. There it is again in verse 1 of chapter 24. In verse 15 and 16, this is another one of those laws breaking through that shows extraordinary compassion and mercy. You shall not give up to his master a slave. And remember what the slaves were like. How would you describe slaves in Israel? Some were captured from another country. That was one way to become a slave. What was another? Yeah, there were debts that could not be paid, and so someone became an indentured servant in order to work off debt, pay the debt. What is interesting here is that this passage is talking about, most commentators think, foreign slaves, that this is a slave from another country alongside Israel. He escapes into Israel, and it says, you shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. He shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him. You shall not wrong him. What's interesting about that is that there's no extradition from Israel. There is no returning a foreign servant who is seeking refuge. He has come for help. And this is very similar to slaves who escaped from the south into the north on the Underground Railroad. And they were considered to be free when they got to one of the free states. Well, in this instance, this is what we're finding in this provision. And one of the commentators I read said that if you did extradition, that would involve a treaty with another country. And Israel was not to make treaties with the nations round about. And so there would be no implication of a treaty allowed whatsoever, even through the act of returning a slave to a foreign master. You shall not wrong him. Verses 17 and 18 are interesting. They're obvious. None of the daughters of Israel shall become a cult prostitute. None of the sons of Israel shall be a cult prostitute. This, of course, is referring to fertility rites done by the Canaanites. Israelites who would go over to Canaanite-style worship once they came into the Promised Land and were tempted to be involved in this. This absolutely forbids it. And it says in verse 18, you shall not bring the fee of a prostitute or the wages of a dog into the house of the Lord your God in payment for any vow, for both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. So there's a lot of controversy about what dog means. It could mean the standard Jewish byword for Gentile, but probably what it means here is a male prostitute. It's actually a male prostitute, and so it's the counterpart to the cult prostitute. What's the passage saying? It's saying how you got your money is important to the Lord, and you must not use ill-gotten gain, dirty money, to make offerings to the Lord and to pay a vow to the Lord. For both of these are an abomination to the Lord your God. Then in 19, it says, you shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. You may charge a foreigner interest, but you may not charge your brother interest, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land that you're entering to take possession of it. What's the difference between a foreigner and a brother? Why would God make such a distinction? Well, it is because of the close bond that God has ordained among his people. And just as the Israelites were each other's brother and sister, so often they were, of course, distant blood kin, because they all were in some way or another descended from Jacob. At the same time, Christians are spiritual brothers and sisters of one another. And so there is the element of family here. But there's also a difference in the kind of situation that would require this borrowing. One of the things that I found real helpful was this comment by Peter Craigie. He says, in the modern world, bank loans, commercial loans, and so on, have become an integral part of daily life, so that it's easy for the modern reader of Deuteronomy to assume that legislation such as this relates to a similar practice. At the time reflected in the book of Deuteronomy, however, Israel's society was not based on a complex commercial and financial structure. Loans were normally made in an attempt to alleviate poverty. And since loans would be made to a fellow Israelite, a brother in a time of crisis, to lend on interest would be an improper thing to do for two reasons. First one, you can probably guess, especially if you've ever borrowed money from one credit card to pay on another. The lending at interest would aggravate the crisis that produced the need. It would only make things worse for the poor guy who was in financial straits. But secondly, it would betray an attitude unworthy of a member of the covenant community. The man wealthy enough to make a loan would be wealthy only because of the gracious provision of God. If then he lent something on interest, money or food, to a fellow in crisis, he would be abusing God's provision. That was the idea. And so God had blessed him in order that he might bless others. So he should lend freely without interest, reflecting thereby his own thankfulness to God and receiving the continued blessing of God. And Jesus said, freely you have received, freely give. This is the principle in Israel. It's not... Huh? I think it has to do... I think what should happen is we shouldn't slavishly follow this because we're not under the law, but I think that we should take into consideration that a Christian is in fact our brother, that we do have that kind of family relationship. So if a loan is to be made, if you're a bank officer and your fellow Christian comes in to ask for a loan, I think that you should do the best you can. As we're saying, this wasn't a system built on that kind of thing. Businesses didn't borrow money from banks and keep paying back loans in order to survive and so on. So within the context of today's business world, yes, I think it's very appropriate for a Christian to exercise compassion for a fellow church member as far as their business will allow them to do it. Yes, John?
That concept that Jews did that, they could loan to each other, they couldn't charge interest, they could loan to Gentiles and charge interest.
Yeah,
Well, in the early church, Christians wouldn't charge each other interest, but they could go to Jews to borrow money. The same progressed in the Middle Ages in Europe, they could borrow with somebody who was a Jewish banker, a whole lot of money, and they suddenly would have a riot. Somehow his house got burned down, he got killed, and all his bank records were destroyed.
I see. Yeah. Yeah. Have you ever noticed that the wickedness of man's heart is the real problem? Whenever you try to make laws or policies or whatever, You always find somebody with a new creative way of being wicked. The law either cannot touch or can be taken advantage of. Any other comments about this? This idea at the end, verse 20, that the Lord your God may bless you in all that you undertake in the land that you're entering to take possession of it. Again, the underlying thought here is that it's God who has blessed you. Verse 21, we've seen a lot about vows in studying the Pentateuch, Leviticus 27 and Numbers 30. You don't need to turn there, but remember all of that extensive list of vows and vows that a wife makes and whether or not a husband hears it or not and that kind of thing. Well, this kind of sums it all up. It says, if you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay fulfilling it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and you will be guilty of sin. But if you refrain from vowing, you will not be guilty of sin. You shall be careful to do what has passed your lips, for you have voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. There's a great passage that runs in parallel to this over in Ecclesiastes. Turn there for just a moment. Ecclesiastes 5:2. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God, for God is in heaven, and you are on earth, therefore let your words be few. That's an excellent passage for many reasons. For a dream comes with much busyness, and a fool's voice with many words. And so it's very easy to make a whole big litany of promises and say you're going to do this and you're going to stop doing that. And we do that kind of thing January 1st and last till about the 3rd every year. And the writer Solomon says, when you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger. The word is angel. Can you sort of imagine there a great, big, old, strong angel that God sends to remind you of your vow? Do not say before the angel it was a mistake. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity. But God is the one you must fear. This means that we ought to be very circumspect. We ought to obey Solomon and let not our words be many. Let your words be few. John Gerstner was one of the great experts on Jonathan Edwards. And some of you may be familiar with a huge two-volume set of the works of Edwards, published by Banner of Truth. And it has print about that big in two unreadable columns. So when you open it up, it looks like two rectangles of gray in the page. It's very difficult to read. But the two-volume set cost about $100, and it was a good way to get all the works of Jonathan Edwards in two, well, I wouldn't say convenient volumes, but two volumes that didn't take up a huge amount of space. And you used to be able to get them at a discount of maybe $65, $70. John Gerstner would give that set to anyone for free. He kept copies of them. He said, I'll give you that set if you'll read it within a year. And people would say, oh, Dr. Gerstner, thank you so much. I'll treasure this always. I'll sure read it in a year. About November, when they were a third of the way through volume one, they would call Dr. Gerstner and say, Dr. Gerstner, it's getting on toward Thanksgiving, Christmas. I don't think I'm going to be able to finish this. And Gerstner would always say, helpfully but unmercifully, "You made a vow to God, not me." So, deal with it. God is your problem, not me. I gave you the books, but your vow is to God. So we need to be careful, just like Martin Luther should have been careful and not said, "Help me, St. Anne, and I'll become a monk." Pay what you vow is the point. And what should be the effect of this? To let our words be few, and we should engage the mind first. Let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak and slow to wrath, said James. No man can tame the tongue. And one of the ways that we have a problem with our tongue is in overpromising. I used to have an uncle that was famous for saying, "I'll see you tomorrow." He was my brother, my mother's sister. And I said, "Are we supposed to see my uncle tomorrow?" She said, "No, he doesn't mean anything by that. That's just something he says. He doesn't mean he's going to see you tomorrow." Well, you've probably met a lot of people who said things like that to you, too, that you just simply knew that if they opened their mouth, they were lying. Well, that's what God doesn't want from us. He wants us to, as the Lord Jesus said, let our yes be yes and our no be no, for anything more than this comes from the evil one. Let's go to the last part, verse 24 and 25. If you go into your neighbor's vineyard, you may eat your fill of grapes, as many as you wish, but you shall not put any in your bag. If you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle to your neighbor's standing grain. What is this a guard against? Stealing. Theft. Absolutely. What kinds of signs do you see posted in all-you-can-eat restaurants? No take-home. Absolutely. You may eat while you're here, but do not take any food home. Well, the idea here is to have compassion on the person traveling through an area. These were not times in which it was easy to pack a lunch or find a lunch, and therefore the person would be hungry. This is a merciful provision of God's, that the person can eat as many grapes as they want, but they can't take a few for the road. They cannot make provision for their supper. They cannot say, "Well, there's not going to be any grapes up at Jericho, so I better get a few more of these." If you go into your neighbor's standing grain, you may pluck the ears with your hand, but you shall not put a sickle in your neighbor's standing grain. So the chapter tonight is full of different combinations of laws. There are laws that shock us with their harshness and laws that incredibly reveal compassion. And it's a chapter very much like what Paul wrote in Romans. Behold the goodness and the severity of God. Behold the goodness and the severity of God. He is severe with his enemies. He is severe about what is unclean. He is severe about false religion and those who have defiled and disfigured themselves. He will not take money that is ill-gotten gain. And he does not want you to charge interest or anything like that. He will hold you to your vows. On the other hand, he will permit, after a decent interval, Edomites and Egyptians to dwell in Israel. He will let you borrow money from someone who will lend it to you and find relief for your poverty without any kind of interest whatsoever. And he will permit neighboring servants from other countries to find asylum, refuge in Israel. Finally, you can eat your fill of grapes as you're passing through. You can pluck the ears with your hand while you're passing through. but don't do more than pass through. Don't. Everybody respects the property rights of the owner of the vineyard and the owner of the field, but that man is commanded to be merciful to those in need. So this is our God, and this is the way He is. He is holy, and at the same time He is just, He is loving, He is compassion, slow to anger, plenteous in mercy. Any other comments on anything we've read tonight? Yes, Marie? Yeah, there. That's right. That's right. He did in fact escape from the wrath of Herod, and out of Egypt, God called His true son, who was the fulfillment of Israel. Yes, Laura.
Presumably her descendants would also be descendants of a Moabite, which included King David.
That's right.
Who was within less than 10 generations of an actual Moabite, but presumably he was not forbidden from going into the sanctuary of the Lord. So,
yeah, and that's...
They only reckon it through male descendants? Were female descendants exempt? Or...
Yes, I think that is the answer, because her husband was a Jew from Bethlehem, and therefore, and of course she wound up in our Lord's genealogy, but this is definitely a way of seeing that the way the Bible looks upon Ruth favorably, and the presence in the genealogy in Matthew 1 is very much of an example of the grace of God. Yes, brother?
Ruthie was considered a proselyte Jew by the time she married Boaz.
Yeah.
But also, this merciful part here, the grain, when you pass in the grain field, the religious leaders, quote unquote, in Jesus' day said, "Why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" Well, number one, there's nothing here about the Sabbath.
No.
But also, they had taken this thing and they said, "Well, you've broken the law on 3 points. So one, you're harvesting grain when you pull the heads.
Yeah.
And then you're threshing grain when you're separating the kernels from the chaff. And in the process, your hands are warming up, thus cooking the grain." So there you go. Nobody, you get a good law here, and some idiot comes along and make some harebrained notion.
Yes, absolutely right. If this is bad, then anything that might possibly someday, under some circumstances, lead up to this is bad too.